Blog Talk Radio.
Like a small boat on the ocean, sending big waves into motion, like how a single word can make a heart open. I might only have one match, but I can make an explosion. And all those things I didn't say were wrecking balls inside my brain. I will scream loud today. Can you hear my voice this time? This is my fight song. Take back my life song. Prove them all right song. My power turned up. Stop it right now. I'll be done. I'll play my fight.
This is Merle with Merle, and I'm your host, Merle Exit. Well, it's as far as I'm concerned, it's a warm, it's a hot and gloomy day, and a lot of humidity. And I'm here in New York City, and right now it's 3:05 p.m. And today we're going to talk about oysters. That's right. I have Stephen Plant. That I'm going to call right now. He has a place in Connecticut. So let's get him on the air. Two ringy dings. Hi. Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Oh, good. Great. Okay, so let's see. The first thing I wanted to ask you is, how you even got started with oysters in the first place, and why?
I spent the early part of my career on Wall Street, and one of the jobs I worked at, one of the last jobs I worked at, was a guy doing venture capital. He ran commodity money, but he decided he wanted to do real stuff, so he got into the venture capital game in commodity-intensive industries. So he sent his small analytical staff out to look for projects. I was one of those people. I started looking at aquaculture because I've lived on the shore my whole life. My dad was a biology teacher. My mom was a botanist. And it just seemed like, you know, there was so much in the news at that time about the Grand Banks closing and all these guys out of work and the fisheries collapse. And I just thought, you know what, we're going to have to grow this stuff. And so I looked at a couple of projects for him, and I guess you could say I got it set the hook. You know, it made so much sense to me that and the timing on Wall Street was right, because I left, parted company with this one guy. I had two other jobs that were absolutely awful. And so I'm like, you know what, I'm going to go a different route. And so I got a job up in Turner's Falls, Mass, with the, at the time, the world's largest recirculating indoor aquaculture facility called AquaFuture. And that's where I started to, just learn the gig. And I ended up wanting to do oysters because I wanted to come back to Connecticut. And in all of my work, research, you know, shellfish are one of those things that fit the rules of aquaculture bill. You can get babies. It's been done for literally thousands of years. They're indigenous to the East Coast, at least the eastern oyster. And, you know, I wanted to come back to Connecticut, and Connecticut sits right in the middle of its range. So I came back, and by luck, through a mutual friend, met this guy named Jim Marco, who is the president of our co-op, and he basically became my oyster mentor. And, 17 years later, I'm still doing it.
Wow. Now, let me also ask you, in terms of like where the oysters are coming from, is it all pretty much the same type of oyster on the East Coast, or?
Okay, let me straighten out right here. Every oyster that anyone buys or consumes on the, or that is grown on the East Coast or caught on the East Coast is one species, Crassostrea virginica, right? That's our native species. It is illegal to import any foreign oyster species. So despite all of the branding and the hundreds of different kinds of oysters, Wellfleets and, you know, wherever, you know, Salt Pond Sweets, they're all Crassostrea virginica.
Right. So, okay. So, in other words, what I'm saying is the farm. You want to call it, is it a farm that when they're farmed?
Yeah. Okay. They grow them in lots of oysters. Get grown in lots of different ways. There are people who still do wild harvest, okay, on natural oysters. There are people that plant shell called culch to attract oyster larvae during certain times of the year. It's called spatfall, and they actually, you know, that's a sort of type of farming. There are people who grow them in contained systems their whole life, like a lot of the guys on the Cape do and in Rhode Island. There are also people that do, like we do some contained during the early part of their life, but then we put them on the bottom. And there's all various reasons for the different methodologies, and each one will result in a different type of product, you know, in appearance and taste, in addition to where they come from, in addition to the season that it is and what the oyster is actually going through in its life cycle. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that, like, let's say I've had various oysters from different places, et cetera, et cetera. If the ones, let's say these particular ones on the East Coast, and you see it on a plate, let's say with oysters from different areas, and would that, you know, would I recognize that it's an East Coast oyster?
Probably, yes. There's a different flavor to it. There are three kinds of oysters popular in this country right now. Three kinds of oysters. There's the eastern oyster, Crassostrea virginica. There's the gigas oyster, which is grown on the West Coast, which is actually a transplant from Asia. They were brought in when the native Pacific Coast oyster, the Olympia, basically between urbanization, industrialization, you know, development and habitat loss, the Olympia oyster pretty much went into decline. You cannot find them except in some very, you know, hoity-toity areas, because they really have, they're not cultured like other oysters are, so they tend to be wild and they show up in places that people don't, and it's kind of a funky thing. The gigas oyster can live anywhere, and that's why that has been very popular. And then there's also the Kumamoto oyster, which is grown on the West Coast too, which is indigenous to Japan.
Right.
And all of these will have a slightly different flavor. Now, the two most popular ones, the virginicas on the East Coast and the gigas. Gigas actually I find to be a little fishy. And in fact, when on the menu it says overtones of cucumber and stuff like that, that type of description, and I've seen them, that's the fishy taste coming through. So what they've done with gigas oysters is instead of growing, gigas oyster will grow extremely large. What they do is these guys are harvesting these things quite small, like 2 inches. And because they harvest them smaller, the fishy flavor does not come out as fishy flavor. It comes out as that cucumber. It's kind of cool. It's a great idea. But it will never have, I don't think it'll ever have that seasonal sweetness that you can get in a virginica. Up in Darmascotta, Maine, they actually do get some Belon oysters. They're European flat oysters, edgeless. But again, very rare, tend to be larger, very flinty tasting, metallic. Really for the connoisseur who's had everything else.
Okay. By the way, when you were talking about these very large oysters, now I understand. I was talking to somebody who must have had these oysters, because he was commenting, said they were so large I could only eat three. And I was one thought to myself, what kind of oysters was he eating? I mean, I've had plump oysters, but I don't know. But I guess this is what you were referring to.
Yes, that's what I'm referring to. And you can actually, though, I will say this, a Virginica oyster can get large and still, sometimes those are really good. I mean, you have to be in the mood for them. It's a really big Eastern oyster, but it will sweet. It's not going to be like, I could not stomach a large Gigas oyster. They're just too fishy for me. They're just not tasty.
Okay.
You know, but I can eat a large Virginica, you know, I mean, it's a mouthful,
right.
but you get them at the, again, you get them at the right season where they're really sweet and they're fine. But they're, again, they're not, so, large oyster like that is not most people's cup of tea.
I mean, would I notice, let's say, the taste difference of, I'm just familiar with some names, like the Wellfleet oyster, the Blue Point
I don't think
oyster.
So. Let me give you my primer of eating oysters. First of all, oyster's flavor, oysters are, let's back up. First of all, there's a seasonal component to oysters, okay? Oysters go through, let's start in the spring. Winter has just ended. Spring is coming on. The waters are getting warmer. Finally, we're reaching 50 degrees. The oysters are starting to pump water. At that time, the oyster will be the thinnest it ever is. It has, generally speaking, it has gone through its winter dormancy and worn and used up all of its fat reserves and sugar reserves that it put on in the fall. So typically, that's when you'll see the finished meats. What you want to look for when you open an oyster is you really want to see a very firm, creamy to white. It can be dark, but it can't be opaque. You don't want to see an oyster meat that's opaque, that you can see through, or that's excessively watery, or sits way down in the cup and there's not much to it. What you want to have is an oyster, and you can't always get this, and it doesn't mean it won't be tasty, but the best ones, if you open an oyster and you look across the top, the bottom shell that you just, you know, you flipped off the bottom shell, you're looking across the top shell, if you see that oyster meat crowning over the shell, that's a home run right there. That's like the pinnacle. Because that's a really healthy animal. It means it's been feeding well, it's growing well, that's the rascal you want to eat. Now, so let's go back to the seasonal component. So in the springtime, you'll have less of that. Now, we've been very lucky. Our oysters go into the fall and winter really fat, and we've actually, like this spring, they looked great. You know, they weren't all crowning, but the meat was nice and firm. It was colorful. It wasn't, you know, wasn't opaque. It wasn't that white. They were solidly healthy. Now, then you get into spawning season. And spawning season, I'm encouraged to not talk about this, but personally, I think it's awesome. Oysters spawn at the peak of summer, end of July, early August, and that can vary depending on where you're in the calendar. And an oyster that's spawning has gonad tissue in it. And what will happen then is that as the oysters come out of dormancy and they start to feed, the first thing they start doing is building up towards spawning. What I typically will actually not mind selling a smaller oyster during spawning season because when they have gonad in them, they are rich and creamy, and there's the oyster that will keep you alive, sustenance. You know, you talk about full of micronutrients and omega-3s and all that other stuff, that's the oyster that's packed with it. It's like an ocean egg, you know? It's like an ocean egg. So then, but a big spawning oyster can have a stronger flavor, and it actually can have a little fishy flavor because it's just packed with this gonad tissue. But again, like I said, I love the smaller ones when they're like that because they'll actually be really sweet because in the gonad tissue is a lot of glycogen, and that's sweet. So between the brininess of the oyster and the sweet from the muscle tissue, top notch. Okay, once oysters spawn, and again, that's late July or early August, depending on where, they will actually go through another period where they've lost some body mass, a percentage of body mass, but they'll immediately start feeding again to put weight on for fall. Because now what they need to do is prepare for winter and that long dormancy. Not so much down south, but certainly up in the north. And it varies depending on your geography. So, again, whenever you see a post-spawn oyster that's still fat, that's not opaque, that's got good color, it's creamy or white or, you know, just a solid color, good, healthy animal. And from there on, it just gets better because these animals will pack on they'll pack on growth, they'll pack on, you know, body mass, they'll store glycogen, which is the when you bite in. If you've never had a sweet oyster, it is a treat. When you bite in there and go, oh, my God, that's so sweet, it's really a treat. And that's what you'll get more and more as you get into fall. And then you kind of complete the cycle in winter. When water temperatures drop into the 40s, the oysters will generally go into dormancy, and whatever they have packed on over the fall will stay with them and slowly, 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 slowly get used up over the course of the winter. So that's the cycle. And as I said, each of those seasons has its own particular characteristic and flavor. So when you ask me, well, will I notice a difference in a Wellfleet? Well, that depends on if it's a Wellfleet during spawning season or in April or in December. And to be perfectly honest, and I hate to confuse the whole issue. I mean, I should be more marketing, but the reality is that I can show you an oyster off my bed and then show you another oyster that was 10 feet away. And those two animals will taste totally different because of the health, you know? So what you want is right, and again, the whole health is what's visible when you open that shell and you smell that fresh flavor, that, you know, oceany stuff, and you look at the meat and you go, wow, that thing is packed. It's packed in that shell. And, you know, it's got great color and it's a nice dark gill, which is the edge that'll go around the outside, also another good sign of animal health. You simply want the healthiest animals you can get. So if you go into a restaurant and you get half a dozen of a certain brand and they all look like that, that's what you're after. You know, if you get your plate and two or three of them look like that, or none of them look like that, and they all look a little shaky and watery, well, you know, it doesn't really matter if they're from Wellfleets or they happen to be mine. That's not cool. And this is one of the things why we focus really heavily on, you know, just we do bottom culture for our grow-up. We want really aerobic, hard bottom oysters to have the oysters sit up really high so they can feed well. Like I said, I had one of my best springs in terms of opening oysters going, wow, this does not look like a spring oyster this year. And again, it's because of bed maintenance. It's because if you take care of the ground that they're on, if you take care of the land, the farm, the oysters will take care of themselves.
Okay.
There will also be sometimes a substantial difference between bottom-grown oysters and cage-grown oysters. I don't like to, you know, be negative about anybody in the business, but let's face it. If you are packing animals into a container to grow them as opposed to having them free-living on the bottom, I'm telling you they're going to be happier free-living, you know. And that's one of the things you'll notice, too. A lot of times with cage or bag-grown oyster, they tend to be a little elongated, kind of misshapen. Now, big improvements have been made by a lot of guys on this front because what they're doing is they're tumbling their oysters. So they're creating through a machine the action that the tides and the contact with the bottom does for me naturally. So these guys are getting bag-grown oysters that look really good. Deep cup, nice and rounded. They've had their growth edge knocked off a few times, so the shells are really robust. Oysters are a creature that thrive in a high-energy, hostile environment, which is the intertidal shoreline. You know, they're exposed in the summer to heat. They got cold in the winter. They're underwater. They're out of water. It's actually a harsh environment. And so we find that the more you kind of handle your animals, they actually do better. You know, every time you knock the growth edge off, as the oysters grow, they put on this what's called growth edge. It looks like little fingernails. And when you knock that off and force them to grow it again, they actually will increase their percentage of body mass relative to shell. They'll increase their shell density and thickness, making a really more robust oyster. So the more you handle them, the better your end product.
I see. But let me also ask you, I know, for instance, like, when you're looking at things like, for instance, like muscles, you can get cultivated muscles, or the muscles are like hanging off the wood in the ocean kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
You know what I'm talking about?
I'm familiar with muscles, yeah.
Okay. So when you're dealing with oysters, I mean, can people, I mean, like when people, they say they dig for clams or whatever. I mean, can you actually find oysters just
You know what it is? Most of the time, you can, but most of the time you have to check the water classification and the regulations that are that body of water. Because a lot of clams will go lots of different places. Oysters tend to grow where in areas that are not actually open to taking of shellfish. Now, I'll give you an example, though. The town of Stonington, which is where I reside, has a recreational oyster program. So we supply oysters to them as part of our licensing fee to use the bottom, and they plant them on the recreational beds, and you can actually go and gather Mystic oysters as part of a recreational shellfish program. So there are places that do it. I'm not aware of a ton of them that do it. The neighboring town of Groton, Connecticut, also has a recreational oyster program. As far as going to just gather them, that I'm not sure. That's a good question. You know, because the reality is, Merle, anytime you're just going to gather shellfish, you need a permit, and you need to know the water classification. Now, that's not saying that lots of people don't go clamming in areas that are technically not open, right? Because they're not approved, because they have a non-point or a point pollution source somewhere nearby. And the FDA, who is the governing body of shellfish consumption in this country, you know, they frown on bacteria, you know, you harvesting shellfish where there's excessive bacteria in the water. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, if humans have been doing it for hundreds of years, doesn't mean it's going to hurt you. It just means legally you got to check the local regulations. But there's good news. Almost every town that has a shoreline on the shoreline will have a shellfish commission. And you can contact them and ask them, hey, are there any opportunities for recreational shellfishing where I can go and gather clams and oysters? And I guarantee you, you will get an enthusiastic volunteer, probably retired, to tell you all about it. Or send you back an email telling you all about it.
Oh, that's interesting. And now, when it comes to, like, shellfish, well, why is it okay to eat oysters raw versus, I don't know if people eat scallops raw, I'm not sure, or, in other words,
You can eat anything raw. You can eat anything raw you want. You just have to make wise decisions. Eating raw food is all about foodborne pathogens, bacteria. There's a number of them. And in order to be confident that you're not going to contract one of these things, you really want to know what you're eating. So the reality is, if I walk into a fish market and buy a slab of tuna and take it home and slice it up thin and make sashimi, well, I don't really know how long that tuna has been out. I don't know when it was caught. I don't know. I have no information about how it was handled. So I could eat it raw, but I have to take my risk. The thing about shellfish is, they are, especially oysters, they are designed to be consumed raw. So you are legally entitled, when you walk into any place that sells oysters and go, I want to see the shellfish tag, and for 90 days, they are required to keep the shellfish tag that came along with that purchase of oysters, that bag of oysters, and it will tell you the company that harvested them, the date they were harvested, the date they were shipped, the lot number that they came off of, so that you could actually trace it back and go, hey, these were harvested 3 days ago. Wow, they're still really fresh. All right?
Uh-huh.
You can't do that with anything else. It is the only food currently available anywhere that I know of on the planet that you can do that with. That you can
That's
go, where,
really,
give me the tag. I want to see where they came from and when they were harvested.
I can imagine. Somehow I can't imagine. When I go to, let's say, an all-you-can-eat buffet and they have oysters on it, I avoid it. Because I don't know.
Well, again, I don't know the reputation of the place you're talking. You know, I would need more information. You got to look at them. Do they look good? Do they smell fresh? You know, you got to use your senses to determine. And then you go, well, where's the tag? How old are these oysters? Typically, at an all-you-can-eat buffet, you know, if I know a restaurant and I know my economics, that stuff they're trying to move. They want to get rid of it. All right. So maybe those are not the oysters you want to eat. But there are tons of places out there, which sound like the place where you got ours, that quality is the name of the game. And moving product through quickly and having a fresh supply and knowing your source, knowing, you know, that's the thing about shellfish. You can know where they came. You can actually, you know, go online to some of these restaurants and fish markets and they'll have bios on the farmer that supplies their oysters.
Oh.
So,
okay.
Yeah. Are you just recording this and you're going to edit it all, right?
No.
Oh, we're really on the radio?
Yeah, we are. We're live.
All right. Well, I'm not going to give you any names then. But
No, you don't have to. Whatever you want to say.
I'll give you a perfect example. There's a company in Boston called Pangea Shellfish. They have a thing, their oysterology section. You can go, and they have a map. They show you where stuff came from. They have a bio on the grower. It's creating all of that cachet for being able to know where your food comes from. And I don't have to tell you or your audience that that is big now. That is a huge movement in food, both farm to table and knowing where your stuff came from. And honestly, shellfish started it. I hate to say it, but shellfish started it because by law, they had to. And rather than look upon that as a regulatory negative, we've turned it into a marketing thing.
Okay. Would a seafood market be more willing to give you that information than a restaurant or vice versa?
They have to. There's no willingness. They are required by law to keep the tag. And you know what? If they can't produce the tag, you got to start scratching your head. Because there are places that will lose the tag or co-mingle product. We had a problem with a particular distributor, and again, not going to say who, an East Coast distributor who was selling Mystic oysters, and they were not Mystic oysters. And it said, right, I got a picture of the tag. It was from a lot somewhere in another part of Connecticut. Clearly not from the lot where ours Mystic oysters come from. So, you know, and honestly, we made a fuss. They stopped and go. Whether or not they stopped because we made a fuss, the customers started to realize, hey, these aren't Mystic oysters because they're used to getting our product. Now they're getting some other stuff, and they're like, these aren't Mystic oysters. So eventually stuff like that kind of short-circuits itself. You know, I mean, when you have customers that know your product, that rely on your quality and know, you know, they get acclimated, and they're not going to put up with crap. And so it tends to police itself.
Now, another question I wanted to ask you, if somebody doesn't want to eat them raw, what's the best way, not going into oyster stew because they're really cooking a long time?
Oh, there are a bazillion ways to cook them and a bazillion different recipes. One of my favorites is I take an equal quantity of breadcrumbs, a grated Parmesan cheese, put some crushed red pepper in there, crushed red pepper. Add enough olive oil to make it like, you know, kind of a, like silly sand, like sand, like wet sand. And just put a dollop of that on the top of the oyster and put it under the broiler. And cook it till there's just a little bit of moisture left in the oyster. Phenomenal. But I mean, that is simple breadcrumbs and cheese. You can do tons. There's tons of stuff you can do.
Right. In other words, basically, you shouldn't cook it. If you want to get the juiciness of it, you shouldn't cook it, like, too long.
No, cook it. I recommend people doing it, cook it until there's still fluid bubbling in the bottom, and that's done. Do not cook it till it's dry. But you do want to cook, because you are, a lot of people have an aversion to eating uncooked or undercooked food, and so they want to cook it thoroughly, but just don't dry up. Don't dry it all up. That's the key.
Yeah. Okay, because I kind of wondered, like, you know, if like a quick way kind of so to enjoy the oyster without
Put a slab of, you can just put a little thing of butter on it and put it under the broiler. I'm a big one for the broiler because I like a top-down heat, but you can do them on the grill. You can pop them on the grill with a little thing of butter on them. It doesn't, look in the fridge, see what you got. Look in the cabinet, see what you got. Fire something together and play.
Would you pan fry them?
Could, yeah. I had a visitor on board today, the local shellfish commissioner wanted to come out and just spend a half day working with me and shoot the breeze. And I sent him home with, you know, a dozen jumbo oysters that he is going to pan fry and make po'boys. He was psyched.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
So you can do all kinds of stuff with them. I have made oyster stuffing at Thanksgiving. I'm personally not a fan of it, but my wife loved it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I wouldn't. Yeah. I tend to eat them raw. Okay, should you chew or slurp?
No, you got to chew. You got to chew. You need to taste it. If you just swallow it without chewing it up, you don't know what the heck taste are you getting out of there.
Yeah. Okay.
No, and you know what? And honestly, that speaks volumes. Because if you don't want to chew it, if you just want to get it down because it's not tasty or something else, that's saying something right there. You want to chew that thing. You want something that's so tasty you're going to go, oh, that was good. Oh, when I bit into that, it just exploded with flavor, and then the aftertaste. You know, there's a whole succession when you eat an oyster, I find, a good oyster. You know, you first get that wash of the liquor, right, which is salty. And then as you chew it, you should get the flavor from the body of the thing, from the actual animal, which can be sweet, it can be whatever flavors. And then you have this kind of finish, which I don't know. To me, it's kind of like... it's like the sea. I don't know. It's hard to describe. It's like the ocean.
Yeah.
I used to describe the smell, too. You got to take a little whiff of them. I used to, like, I combo of the ocean and fresh-cut grass and marine algae. You know, just a really earthy but marine, clearly marine aroma. Yeah. You know, they need to smell like that. They need to smell good.
Yeah. I had... So we just swallowed them only because I was in a contest, this oyster eating contest, and I volunteered. It's like, you know, they wanted somebody. I was the only female standing around there, and they said, "How about you?" And I said, "Sure, okay." And I had remembered at one point being able to just, you know, get them down the throat. No, I said, well, it was a contest. So kind of that's what I did, and I would have won, but I was competing against the mayor of the town, who cheated because when he said he finished, he was still chewing. But
well, you gave it a good shot, though. That's all right.
Yeah, that's what I did. But anyhow, so is there anything else you wanted to add to this?
No, I would say, you know, maybe what I would say is search out good oysters, you know, because a lot of people are reticent about eating them. You know, they're reluctant, and believe me, there's a lot of crap out there. There really is a lot of crap, little tiny ones that have no body to them, that have no flavor. But go find a place that's got a good reputation and go sit there, you know, have a beer or have a meal and ask for three or four and ask the guy to recommend a really plump oyster and give it a try. I'll be honest with you. I got roped in, but now I gladly do it. The American Legion Parade, we operate in Noank, Connecticut, which is a little village, part of Groton, Connecticut. And it's one of the oldest running parades in Connecticut, runs through Noank. It's the American Legion Parade on the 4th of July. Oh, no, it's Memorial Day. I forgot, whatever day it is. They get me every year. And this year, I initiated four people who had never had an oyster before or who had had a bad experience and gave them one of ours. You know, gave them a small one, a nice little plump one, and they're like, wow, that was really good. And I got four people to retry or try for the first time an oyster and love them.
That's great.
But you have to have the right product.
Yeah.
Actually, we were at a little gathering last night with my daughter's friends' parents. You know, the parents kind of get together, and she's like, "Oh, I can't eat oyster." I'm like, "You didn't have the right oyster." So she'll be back up visiting in the fall, and I told her we have a date. You are gonna try one of my oysters that I select, and I'll bet you, I'll make a bet with you right now that you go, "Wow, that's better than I thought it would be." And then you go, that was good. So, yeah, I mean, that's what I would say. You got to give them, try good oysters. For anybody of your listeners who goes, "Oh, I had bad oysters, da-da-da," or got sick, or that's not oysters. That's the wrong oyster.
I definitely understand. So, I totally appreciate your talking to us and giving us the 101 about this. And
you're very welcome. And I'm going to put a plug in and sit there and remind your listeners that we grow Mystic Oysters. They're from Noank, Connecticut. And you can, I don't know where you got yours, but you can go on my website, ct-oysters.com, to find out where we sell them, get information about how we grow them, who we are. You can also go to mysticoysters.com. That's another one. There's basically two of us that hold the Mystic Oysters trademark, and we sell to different people. And some people say that's confusing, but I think who cares? It doesn't matter. You know, Jim and I are constantly, you know, I personally am constantly going back and forth looking at his product, and he's looking at mine, and we almost have this little thing going on about who's got the better stuff right now, you know? And that just makes it better. That just raises the bar, and it just makes you really want to do a good job. And you know, the critters love where we grow them. They really respond. Like I said, they just get better all the time with us as we work that bottom, as they, you know, refine our techniques and, good stuff.
Okay. Well, okay, I'm going to go put this up on my Facebook for everybody to hear.
All right, and I got another hour of work, and then I'm out of here. And I'll have a cold one.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, you got it. And I'll email you the link, too.
Awesome. Thanks, Mel. Okay.
Okay.
Great.
All right.
Great.
Steve,
have a good rest of the day.
Great talking to you.
You too.
Too.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. Oh, yes. Well, of course, now I'm in the mood for oysters. But, what can I do? I'm going to get... I just ordered sushi. No oysters, though. But... anyway, so I'm going to end the show now. For wherever you are, day, night, weather, whatever, enjoy the show. And who knows what's next. I think I'm off to an Indian restaurant in a couple of days. Yeah. The chickens are sleeping.